From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. You know that thing in time travel stories where if the time traveler steps on a butterfly, the entire world of the future changes irrevocably? Well, journalist Charles C. Mann is my guest, and his latest book, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created, sort of follows the effects of all the butterflies trampled underfoot by European explorers and settlers in the New World. Charles C. Mann, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Pleasure to be with you.
You know, there's so many little things that affect everything in your book, and I was thinking, how do you go about writing this book? How did you keep track of everything? Do you work backwards or follow the threads forward or what?
Well, I guess the answer to all that is yes. Well, really, I had this overarching idea that kind of helped orient me, and that's the idea of the Columbian Exchange. This is a term invented by this wonderful historian, Alfred Crosby, a couple decades ago. And the idea is that the reason that Columbus is important, if you're a scientist, is that for tens of millions of years, the two hemispheres, the Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere, were separate. They'd been, you know, broken up by geological forces. When originally there was just one single continent called Pangaea. It got broken up. And as a result, they developed completely different suites of plants and animals. And these ecosystems in the two halves of the world hadn't really touched each other for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And the reason that Columbus is important is that, in effect, he recreates this original continent of Pangaea by bringing the continents together, he and the Europeans who follow him. And this ecological convulsion has ricocheting effects all over the world. And essentially, my book is just trying to follow those ripples.
But how did you follow them specifically? I mean, which direction do you go, forwards or backwards?
Well, in a sense, both. You know, what I was trying to do in the book, because there's so many examples, as you point out, was to focus on a few of the big ones, the ones that seemed to me to make a huge, huge difference in world history, and then, you know, as I had time to tuck in little tales by the side. And so the most important, probably part of the Columbian Exchange for us in the United States, is the introduction of malaria from Europe and Africa to the Americas. And this has this profound impact all over the Americas and plays a role in all kinds of things, ranging from the Revolutionary War and the Civil War to the introduction of slavery in parts of the Americas. And by focusing on this one example, you can then sort of see the sort of spiraling consequences that come from that.
Well, that slavery one was so fascinating. Can you sort of do it for us? How does the mosquito cause slavery?
Well, malaria, malaria is caused by a single-celled creature called Plasmodium. There's a whole bunch of species of Plasmodium, but there's only two that are really particularly important in this context. And all of them, the ones that affect people, are carried by mosquitoes, these little single-celled creatures. And when the mosquitoes bite us, this particular type of mosquitoes called Anopheles mosquitoes, they bite us and they essentially inject us with these single-celled parasites. And these parasites, which are adapted for our body, go through a whole bunch of changes in our body and end up basically hijacking huge numbers of our red blood cells, reproducing inside them, and then ripping them apart and bursting in and flooding through our bodies, at which point we're bitten by another mosquito, and then the cycle goes on again because that mosquito injects somebody else. And it turns out that malaria, and then its sort of companion disease, yellow fever, made much of the Americas effectively uninhabitable for Europeans. Now, Africans who were brought over for a variety of genetic reasons were actually much less susceptible to malaria, and many were immune to yellow fever as well. And the result was that if you were a plantation owner and you wanted labor, you could either get European indentured servants or you could get African slaves, and the slaves would be much more likely to survive. And so the result is that in the malaria areas, which are roughly in this continent south of the Mason-Dixon line, it's much more economically advantageous to have slavery. And economic forces being what they are, it kind of pushes people into slavery. Now, there's lots of other causes of that, but this is a big one. And so that there's this striking fact that in the areas in which the mosquito, the Anopheles mosquito, and the parasite can survive, you have intense slave societies. And roughly that's from right at the Mason-Dixon line down south.
So and you talk about this in the book, the Mason-Dixon line is not a, it's not very arbitrary, that line.
Yeah. Well, it happens to be the line that, well, there was sort of a striking coincidence. It happens to be the line that was surveyed by, you know, Mason and Dixon between the Pennsylvania and Maryland border. But that line is also very, very close to where malaria is a constant threat in the Americas and where it is not. North of that line, it's not. South of it, it is. And there's also this huge cultural dividing line that still is in the Americas. And I guess I'm kind of arguing that all these things are related to each other, and that this enduring division in American society is related to, you know, the habitat for mosquito and the single-cell parasite.
So you do talk about how slavery is not exactly profitable, and yet it existed anyway. So
yeah, well, it is profitable. What I'm talking about is that Adam Smith, in The Wealth of Nations, one of the interesting things about, which is this sort of foundational book for economics that he wrote in the 18th century, he puzzles about why would slavery exist. And what he says is, look, think about it. If you have an indentured servant, the way that indentured servants work is you're a plantation owner in some place like South Carolina, and you need labor for your rice fields or your cotton fields, whatever it is. You go over to England and you pay for the passage of some poor person who can't afford to come over by him or herself. And then they work for you for 4 to 7 years to pay off their passage, and then there's a little bit of profit for you. And then you let them go, and then they get together, have a fresh start, and, you know, get their own land. And, you know, the way Adam Smith puts it, that's a sensible system, and people will work for you, and they're also good workers because they speak your language and will do and know what you want. Now compare this to Africans who don't speak your language and are from Western Central Africa, which are, you know, forested areas that are extremely different from England, so don't know what kind of crops you grow. I mean, they have no experience growing temperate crops. And on top of that, have no interest in working for you whatsoever. They want to kill you, right? All you've done is deprive them of their liberty. They have no incentive to do a good job at all. And so Adam Smith said, why would any rational person choose the slave? And he wrestles with this at 3 or 4 points in The Wealth of Nations and never really comes up with a good solution, as far as I can make out. And it wasn't until the 1970s that some English historians looking at the question suddenly saw that there's a huge difference in the disease environment. And one of them, Philip Curtin, calculated that the slave is a better deal than the European indentured servant at anything up to 3 times the price of the European servant. And so there's the disease puts the thumb on the scale and pushes these areas, nudges them towards being slave societies. And so there's slavery all over the Americas. I'm speaking to you from Massachusetts. Massachusetts is the first English colony to legalize slavery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, far ahead of Virginia or the Carolinas or the places where it's associated with. But Massachusetts, which has slaves, never becomes a slave society in the way that Virginia and the Carolinas and Georgia become slave societies. And that, I argue, has something to do with the fact that Massachusetts never has this kind of constant presence of malaria in the way that those places do.
Because it had fewer puddles.
It is. Say that again?
Because it had fewer puddles.
Yeah, it had fewer puddles and it was colder. And the mosquitoes didn't do as well there, and particularly the parasite didn't do as well there. The parasite to survive, which is this Plasmodium parasite, and the particular one we're talking about is called falciparum, Plasmodium falciparum, needs 3 weeks in which 24/7 the temperature is above 66 degrees. And where I live in New England, that just never happens. You know, down at night, it goes down to the 50s, even in the middle of July. And you have to go down to south of the Mason-Dixon line before you start getting that.
We're talking with Charles C. Mann, and his new book is the fascinating 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. Now, I don't know if your mind works this way, but now that you know everything that can possibly be known, if you could go back in time knowing, you know, what you know now, you know, what butterflies would you step on? I mean, are there simple things that could have been done to make the world less miserable place for those for whom it is a miserable place?
Well, one of the big parts of this biological exchange that's sort of sobering to think about is that among the first of these sort of hidden biological passengers that Europeans brought over in this, you know, meeting of ecosystems were diseases. And by a quirk of evolutionary history that we can talk about if you want to, there are many more communicable deadly diseases in Europe and Asia than there were and Africa than there were in the Americas.
And do you know? Do you have a? Do you know why? Of course, you know why.
Yeah. Well, the reason is that by another the quirk of evolutionary history is that about 15,000 years ago, you know, give or take a little bit, most of the large mammals in the Americas died. There's a real die-off, and scientists are still arguing about the cause. And at that time, there were lots of presumably domesticable animals in the Americas, but none of them were domesticated. This is before, you know, any kind of domestication had occurred anywhere else in the world. But because they died, for reasons, again, to go and understand, native people over here in the Americas had very, very few domestic animals. They had dogs, and in the Andes, they had llamas and alpacas, but essentially that was about it. I mean, there's some smaller examples, but that was the main ones. Whereas, and so there was no cows, there are no horses, there are no sheep, there are no goats, no chickens, there are no ducks, there are no, you know, none of these that are common in Europe and Asia and Africa. And the reason this is important is that, you know, early farmers, lived with their animals. You know, they basically lived in barns. They shared their living space with them. And as we now know, every now and then, an animal disease, can mutate, jump the species barrier, as they say, and become a human disease. And we've seen that recently with bird flu. And most of the great killers in human history are just this kind of disease. They're called zoonotic diseases by scientists. And so, you know, smallpox is either comes from horses or camels. There's a bit of an argument about that. Measles, which is, you know, kills untreated about 8% of the people who get it, something like that. It comes from cattle. It's called bovine rinderpest. So does tuberculosis, which is originally a cattle disease. Rabies comes from bats, and, you know, whooping cough, pertussis comes from poultry. Flu comes from poultry, and on and on and on. And because there were no other domestic animals over here, those diseases didn't evolve. And so what happened when Europeans came is they unknowingly brought over these diseases. And I say unknowingly because they didn't have a germ theory of disease. They didn't understand what they were. And it's something like the suffering and death that these diseases had caused over the past however many millennia in Europe and Asia and Africa were compressed into something like 150 years over here, and somewhere between two-thirds and 90% of the original inhabitants of the Americas died. It was the worst demographic catastrophe in the history of the human species, and it has an awful lot to do with why, you know, small groups of poorly equipped Europeans at the end of very long supply chains were able to, you know, survive and even thrive in alien ecosystems.
Well, so what could you have done, you know,
well,
to prevent that?
You know, if I were a time traveler,
yeah,
you could have simply put Europeans in quarantine for a while.
Uh-huh.
That would have, you know, you. And if you had done that, it would have been much, would have been very, very difficult. If you had said, you know, since I'm an omnipotent time traveler, I would have said, all Europeans' boats have to stay out. You know, before they land, they have to stay out in the harbor for a month.
Uh-huh.
And what that does is gives any diseases on there time to burn through the ship and just go, you know, go get out. But, you know, I don't know how long this would have lasted, but it certainly would have given them,
a fighting
chance. Native populations a better chance.
Yeah.
Huh. I mean, that's just fantasy, though, right?
Well, yeah, but that's fun. I couldn't help having those fantasies as I was reading your book because there's so many little tiny things. Back to your process, do you have like a bulletin board with a string that you...
No, I use... I spend a tremendous amount of time trying to organize stuff. And so I guess I tend to do a lot of it kind of virtually in a hodgepodge. I have to say I've recently acquired this new writing software called Scrivener.
Uh-huh.
And at the advice of a couple writer friends of mine, and maybe this will take over my organization problems now, because it allows you to keep all your notes and the writing stuff that you do all in one sort of package. I'm kind of excited about this. So maybe I should say is that I've been looking all my life for something like this.
Huh.
And I attempt to reproduce it, you know, in a half-hearted way, in a half-baked way on my computer before this.
Uh-huh. That sounds interesting.
Not to sound like I'm giving you a commercial or anything.
No, I'm
kind of psyched about this.
I'm fascinated. So what's more interesting, Scrivener or Earthworms?
Earthworms, but you know, for me, the one is at least looking like a pretty useful tool.
Yeah. Well, so speaking of Earthworms, that was a pretty fascinating thing. So the Earthworms were brought over when they brought over plants. They didn't purposely bring over.
And what we're talking about is that, and this is something that I was just flabbergasted to learn. And as it happens, it's kind of a funny story. As I mentioned, I live in Western Massachusetts, and we have some friends who have a tree farm here, and we were visiting them, and I was astounded one day to discover that they are fighting the good fight against earthworms, and they're denouncing earthworms, and what they told me was that earthworms weren't native to the northern part of North America, that all of them were invaders, and that they are just absolutely wrecking ecosystems in places like Massachusetts and Minnesota and Maine and Alberta, and that we should, you know, do everything we could to control them. Of course, I've been raised with the idea that earthworms are, you know, these wonderful things in our gardens. And so I thought Laura and Bob are crazy. a few days later, I was still thinking about this, and I thought, I wonder if this could possibly have some remote connection to reality. And lo and behold, everything they said was completely true. and earthworms were an example of the Columbian Exchange, that these forests that I live in now, you know, a few hundred years ago had no earthworms and had a completely different ecological character as a result, and that there was this kind of stealth invasion by the earthworms, which we now think are, you know, these great native species, but aren't.
You know, I've traveled a bit. I've been to a few continents, and wherever I go, I see pigeons. They're the exact same pigeons. They seem to be. Why are there pigeons all over the place? Do you have any theory about that?
Yeah, because pigeons will follow. Pigeons are like seagulls. They'll follow ships. And also, pigeons were also intentionally brought over by pigeon breeders. Because people use them for passenger pigeons and not passenger pigeons, for, you know, homing pigeons and this kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
There's these pigeon fanciers.
Yeah, they're all over the place.
And that's exactly the same way that the European bumblebee, you know, the bee that that we look around at, in fact, you know, if you've probably read it, in fact, the bee that is now threatened by mites and different types of diseases is, in fact, an exotic invader. And most entomologists I talk to believe that when European bees came over, they probably drove, you know, hundreds of native species of bee extinct.
Hmm.
And we think of them as this, you know, sort of cute little thing that provides us with honey. But in fact, they're, you know, this tremendously lethally effective ecological engineer.
Wow. We're talking with Charles C. Mann. His book is called 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. When I was reading all about China and money and all that stuff, I wondered, well, how come China didn't colonize the world? Why did Europe colonize the world?
Well, there's a couple of reasons, but I think it boils down to the fact that the Pacific is bigger than the Atlantic.
Mm.
It's a lot bigger than the Atlantic. And from China, from where China would main coast, which is main ports, which are on the southeast part of the country, the wind currents are pretty unfavorable. And to go, in this case, east, you know, to where the Americas were, they have to make a big arc and go north. And this was just unlikely for them to go because there wasn't anything there that they knew about. Whereas, given the development of European technology, it was absolutely inevitable that they were, you know, by around 1500 that they were going to hit the Americas. And in fact, Columbus was sort of an odd thing. Much more likely was what happened actually in 1500, 8 years later, completely independently of Columbus, which is when a guy named Cabral, a Portuguese guy, was trying to go around Africa. And again, the currents along the African coast aren't particularly favorable, and so you have to swoop out west. He was trying to get down to the bottom of Africa, to the southern tip, and you swoop out west to avoid the unfavorable currents, and he bonked into Brazil. And that was going to happen. There's no real sort of obvious path for the Chinese. And in fact, it took decades for the Spaniards to figure out they could go relatively easily the other way. In fact, Magellan did that in the 1520s. But it took another 40 some years and numerous failed attempts before they were able to figure out how to go from west to east across the Pacific.
Why do you think it happened all at the same time, right then, and in the 1490s?
Europeans, who are part of relatively poor part of the world at that point, are really, really interested in connecting up with Asian luxury goods like silk and porcelain. Like if you're a rich European and you can get some Chinese porcelain for your dinner table and get some Chinese silk for your clothes, this is like a pretty big deal. It's a way for you to be wealthy. The big problem is that there's these middlemen in between who limit the supply and jack up the prices, and they're Venice and its sort of effective commercial allies in the Middle East, where all these Islamic societies. And so Europeans are really interested in bypassing them, and at that same time, they develop the technology for long-distance shipping, for having ships that can go long distances. And Spain, which has spent hundreds of years getting rid of these Islamic societies that have dominated that part of the world, it's kicked them out of Spain, now has this commercial imperative, the technology, and also the strong desire to get all these sort of adventurers who've been useful in kicking the Moors out, having them gainfully employed, maybe sending them off on ships so that they can go and do something in China. And all these things combined together to produce kind of an explosion of long-distance shipping that stumbles across the Americas.
So you did 1491.
Yes.
And 1493. What's next? What are you going to do next? You still have
I've kind of run out of numbers.
You don't. You skipped that one big year of 1493.
Yeah, well,
people covered that already.
Yeah, well, it's partly because, as I learned, the more I thought about it, the fact is that Columbus and the processes that he began really are a huge hinge point in history, sort of before and after. And before, in the Americas, there's this whole other world that is, changed forever by the arrival of Europeans. Then that's what I wrote 1491 about.
Right.
But then there's this creation, literally, of globalization very quickly, and that this globalization is as much ecological as it is economic. And the creation of this kind of modern world that we live in happens very rapidly after Columbus, and that's really what 1493 is about. And
Do you think there was ever anything with that huge an impact? Would you say, computers or whatever could ever have that kind of impact that the Columbian Exchange had?
That's a really good question. It's hard to imagine what could have more impact than the discovery of half of the world, the encounter with half of the world. That's pretty huge, no matter how you go about it. Everything changed. I suppose it would be equivalent to, the closest you could come to would be equivalent to discovering another habitable planet full of people.
Which could happen.
Yeah, but that certainly could happen, and that would be a very big deal, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So maybe that would be kind of equivalent to what happened. It's as if we had discovered, another planet full of people.
And if we did, do you think that we would immediately kill them all and enslave them as we did?
Who knows? A lot of the killing that was done was accidental. I mean, it wasn't like that the Spaniards and the English were great humanitarians. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
They hoped that the Indians would work for them. They didn't want them to die.
Mm-hmm.
The enslaving slavery was a part of the world at that time. I mean, it exists in every aspect of the world. It exists in Africa and in Asia and in Europe as well as in the Americas. And now it's almost gone. So there's been a real change there. I mean, slavery is sort of a normal part of the human condition until the 19th century. So it's possible that we wouldn't do this. It's also possible that we wouldn't, kill them. In this hypothetical case, it's sort of fun to think about, isn't it?
Yeah.
That I think biologists would argue that we probably couldn't kill them in the same way because our microorganisms would be very, you know, contrary to H.G. Wells, our microorganisms would be very unlikely to infect them.
Yeah, that's the whole crux of War of the Worlds, right?
Right, and but, and actually, apparently, that's extremely unlikely. I mean, if they're completely different from us, they probably would be impervious to our microorganisms.
When Europeans conquered North and South America, they didn't consider the savages to be human beings, right?
Right. Well, actually, there's a lively argument about that, and the sort of sad part is that the official Spanish and the Vatican sorts, they had this big argument, and they basically concluded that they were human beings. But when it got right down to the ground, the colonists didn't pay any attention to what the king or the pope said, and tried to gather up and force them to work for them. And when the king passed, the Spanish king passed what's called the New Laws in the 1540s, saying, you can't enslave the Indians, the colonists essentially rebelled, and they killed one of the colonial leaders in Peru the viceroy who tried to enforce the rule. So the type of rugged individualist, you might say, who came to the Americas wasn't really particularly disposed to listening to this kind of thing.
Well, your book is endlessly fascinating. It's called 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. And, we just sort of scratched the surface. So everybody should read it's about 500 pages. So get started now.
I'd like to say, wait a minute, though. Yeah. A lot of those pages are notes and pictures and stuff like that. It's not actually that long.
Okay, 400 pages.
350, I think, really. I just don't want to scare people. It is 500 pages when you count everything, but you shouldn't count everything.
But it's absolutely involving. It's like a novel almost. I mean, it's great read. I really enjoyed
reading it
very much. And I've been looking forward to having you on the show. And I wonder if you wouldn't come back. A book will come out in paperback. You come back and we'll talk some more.
Absolutely. Give me a call.
That would be great. Charles C. Mann, thanks so much for being on From the Bookshelf.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
That closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll come back and see us again next week. And in the meantime, that you'll check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes and Facebook. The production of From the Bookshelf is aided and abetted by Francis Venegas. Thank you, Francis. And I want to thank my guest, Charles C. Mann, his amazing new book, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.